From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, Tracing the History and Culture of Mexican Drug Cartels, the journalist Yoan Grillo writes about meeting one of the members of a drug gang, Gonzalo. The man is in prison now, but the arc of his career reflects the larger story of the cartels in that country. Gonzalo began as a petty smuggler, but by the time he was arrested, he had become a soldier in a paramilitary death squad. Grillo says his book is about the criminal networks that paid Gonzalo. It tells the story of these gangs' radical transformation from drug runners to a full-on criminal insurgency. Today in the program, Yoan Grillo will join us to talk about the culture of this criminal movement, their customs and music. He'll talk about where the movement is headed and what can be done to stop it. His book is called El Narco. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to know the exact numbers of those killed in the escalating violence in Mexican border towns where drug cartels fight over money and territory. The journalist Yoan Grillo says in his book that tells the story about these gangs. It talks about their radical transformation from drug runners to a full-on criminal insurgency. Today in the program, Grillo is joining us to talk about the culture of this criminal movement, their customs, their music. Also, he talks about where the movement is headed and what can be done to stop it. His book is called El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Yoan Grillo is a journalist, a writer, a TV producer living in Mexico City. For the last decade, he has reported on Latin America for a long list of publications, including Time Magazine, Al Jazeera, the PBS NewsHour. El Narco is his first book, and he's joining us today from a studio in Mexico City. And Yoan Grillo, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's good to be here.
Well, I wanted to start with one of the narco characters that you write about, and you tell about early in the book, a man named Gonzalo. He had spent nearly 20 years working as this soldier for a Mexican drug gang. When you found him, he was in prison, in a prison cell there in Ciudad Juarez. Tell us a little bit about Gonzalo and what you were hoping to learn from him. Let's start with him.
Well, meeting all these people is quite challenging and quite difficult. You know, you're talking to people who have committed horrific murder. This man, Gonzalo, had killed many more people than he could count. He had decapitated people, some while they were still living. So he committed some quite horrific crimes, and it's hard to try and understand where these people are coming from. Who are they as human beings, and how come they can take part in these terrible acts? And one thing I learned from him was it's quite strange when you're talking to them and looking them in the eye, you don't seem to see a total psychopath, a born psychopath in front of you. You seem to see a person who has followed choices in life that seem to be the best for him, and gradually being drawn into a war, what he sees as a war. So to understand this, they're kind of combatants in a war zone. That's how they see it. And commit horrific acts of murder like many soldiers commit them in war zones throughout the world. It's not a tool to justify these terrible things. It's just to try and explain and understand, to find a way out of this, how people have got into this situation.
And it seems like the arc of Gonzalo's career as a soldier, and then, you know, he's this sort of petty courier in some ways, becomes something much larger. The arc of that career seems to reveal the way the industry, these cartels have evolved in Mexico themselves.
That's right. I mean, in Mexico, in the last few years, we've seen a real radical transformation in these cartels. And if you look back, you know, to the good old days, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and you remember, you know, perhaps the images from Cheech and Chong movies, you know, where you saw these guys trafficking marijuana, you know, kind of happy-go-lucky guys. And today you see images of 50 guys in ski masks with AK-47s, RPGs, attacking police bases, fighting military convoys, kidnapping people en masse, leaving mass graves with 200 bodies. Absolutely incredible, extraordinary things happening here. So we really have to get a grip on this and understand and ask ourselves, what is happening in this country, Mexico? This has very important implications for Mexico, for the United States, and for the whole world.
Essentially, what the book is about is how these drug networks evolved. And in the book, though, you say that there's this broader lesson to be learned, that you say that the problems in Mexico are being played out across the world. You say this is a case study in criminal insurgency. What's the bigger picture that you're seeing there?
Well, we're now living in the 21st century. Many of the ideas we had in the 20th century of political problems have changed quite a lot. We used to think of insurgents as purely being ideological insurgents, you know, Maoists, sometimes religious extremists, sometimes nationalists. But in today's world, we're seeing in many countries groups who are really overwhelming governments and really destabilizing governments who have no real ideology. They're criminals, criminal warlords, or other related kind of groups. And we see different factors that strengthen them. One is the movement of small arms, of AK-47s, RPGs that are rapidly moving around. The other is the movement of money. And the other is the movement of the drug industry and how the drug industry can really help these groups. So we see other countries like, for example, Honduras is very unstable right now. Even in Jamaica, we saw 70 people killed over the arrest of a drug baron. We see in Brazil a group called the Red Commando who torched buses, killed dozens of policemen, torched banks in one day in one coordinated offensive. So many countries now, we're also seeing countries in the Arab world now, which are seeing a great new birth of democracy in Libya, in Tunisia, in Egypt. But we have to worry about these countries as well, of where they could be in 10 years, in 15 years, because Mexico, when I first arrived here in 2000, was having a similar celebration of democracy, ending 71 years of one-party rule, and now we're seeing this very difficult situation in this country.
It's so interesting how in the word insurgency is so packed with meaning, and you get this resistance from the Calderon government, for example. They don't like the idea of the term. The Obama administration, you write about, sort of goes back and forth between seeing this as kind of a case of inner city crime, and then it becomes something larger. And you point out, you know, Mexico is this advanced country, $1 trillion-plus economy, an educated middle class. They have all these great resorts and all these great museums. And is it possible that they're being threatened by this insurgency? So the term is really fraught with all kinds of meaning.
That's correct. And in this conflict, people are even lost for language to understand it. You know, this conflict has happened over the last few years. And like I said, first Hillary Clinton, when she first swore in as Secretary of State, visited Mexico and said, well, it's a bit of a problem like we used to have in the Bronx back in the 1980s. Nothing really to worry about too much. Then she came the following year and she said, oh my gosh, we're starting to see a criminal insurgency in Mexico. We're seeing car bombs and all this kind of thing. And like you say, Mexico is a very advanced country that has 12 billionaires. It has the richest man on the planet, Carlos Slim, who is, you know, worth some $70 billion. It has an educated middle class. It has the vast majority of people who have electricity and are literate and so forth. But it really is seeing an extraordinary criminal threat. It is seeing these armed groups moving around who are completely overwhelming police forces and soldiers in parts of the country. I mean, we see every day situations where you have 10 policemen being kidnapped, murdered and dumped on streets. And that's not even big news anymore. We see abandoned mine shafts with more than 50 bodies. We saw one single massacre of migrants, captured migrants by a drug cartel, of 72 people being killed. Now we say, oh, this is a mafia problem like Al Capone. Al Capone, in his most famous massacre, killed 7 people. And in one massacre here, we've seen 72 people being killed. So we have to use a language which shows the dimensions of this problem. It has gone beyond a situation of cops and robbers. It really has gone to a question of national security. And criminal insurgency is about the best way we can describe this at the moment.
How do you tease out, as a reporter, the truth in all of this chaos? I mean, you talk about how every view is clouded by rumors and deceit. I mean, how do you know who to believe and who to trust. And I mean, where did you find, you know, a sense of the truth, I guess, as you're sort of working through all of this?
Yeah, again, a very good central question about this. In many ways, this book is about my 10 years covering this issue and trying to solve this riddle of Mexican drug cartels. Who really are they? When I first came, you see these figures on the news, El Narco, they refer to them collectively, El Narco, almost like a ghost, who makes $30 billion a year trafficking drugs to the United States, kills all these people. We don't really know who they are. So it was a kind of decade of really trying to get to the bottom of this story and trying to pursue it through every way I could journalistically. Mm. Part of that was talking to the police, the undercover American agents, the Mexican soldiers on the front line, the lawyers who represent drug traffickers, but also getting to the people involved themselves and telling their stories from some people on the lower levels, the traffickers who are paid to smuggle cocaine to the United States, to farmers who are growing marijuana, to the paid assassins who are really caught up in this war. I'm trying to say this is a big, difficult picture, but it's a very important story we all have to look at. The United States has to really wake up to this problem, because it's whatever the United States says or however it wants to be or doesn't want to be involved in Mexico, it really is knee-deep in this conflict. I mean, there's American agents undercover fighting this war on the ground. There's American drug money. There's American government money. There's American guns on both sides. So it really is a conflict which the United States has to try and have some more cohesive policy towards.
The book is, by no stretch, is it a memoir, but it does seem, you do write about your own contact with the drug trade, which began more than two decades ago, far away from Mexico, we should say, the sort of the casual drug use where you saw growing up in Brighton, England. You were personally touched by drug addiction. You talk about friends, two brothers, in fact, dying of overdoses or being affected in that way. Is that connection to the story is the thing that made you want to understand this in a deeper way?
I think the connection between drug use in Europe and the United States and drug trafficking and drug production in Latin America or in Afghanistan or in Africa, in Morocco and so forth, is very, very important. They aren't two isolated stories. It's, no. You know, it's the substance passes hands, and it can be some guy in a peasant in Mexico growing some drugs, or some guy trafficking at the border, and then some kids in England or the United States who are taking these drugs. So we really have to make that connection. Now, I grew up in a city where there's a lot of drug use. I saw a lot of people touched by this. I saw tragedies in certain families from heroin addiction and heroin overdoses. And for me, it was important to understand it, to understand those connections, and to try and make a better sense of this. I think we have to try and do better as journalists to join the dots here, and better as societies to face and confront these problems. So yeah, I think it was a big inspiration, a big kind of driving point to make that connection. Though I say I don't come from a kind of moral point of view of saying, well, you know, the person who took heroin was a bad person deep down, or trying to kind of blame people for his death in that way. It's about trying to understand it and make better sense of this. And obviously those, you know, for those families, it would be, they would love to see their children still alive today.
Well, a good part of the book is not just about drug policy and, you know, the economic conditions, but it's about culture. It's how the culture works, how the culture has evolved to take us where we are. That seems an important point for you. How these cultures work, how they think, their sense of faith, their customs, their traditions.
That's right. I mean, the drug cartels have become a major movement, a social and political phenomenon. So it's not enough just to kind of have the police stories of these top gangsters that you're told by the, you know, by the DEA or by the FBI or so forth. You have to understand that in these communities, they refer to the drug cartels as the movement. They say, you know, are you involved in the movement? Are you involved in the ambience, in the environment? And it is a whole culture, In some cases, there's religious beliefs connected to the drug traffickers. There's a whole lifestyle. They're often revered in their communities. In some places, they're referred to as valientes or brave ones. They're considered the heroes who have risen up and beaten the system, a system which condemns many people to a life of poverty. They have beaten it and become rich. So we have to understand this again to try and confront this problem. You know, again, people say, well, gangster culture is bad, the same way people condemn gangster rap in the United States and say, well, this pollutes our children. Maybe it's the case, maybe not, but we have to understand it if we want to somehow challenge this and get young people not to fall into the hands of criminal empires, but to pursue different life choices.
Well, you're right about the fact that this isn't just random violence. I mean, if you think about it as random violence, there is no way of figuring out what to do about it. But you say there are these, and we'll talk about it as we go along, there are these identifiable factors here. There's a clear time frame, which we'll talk about as well. And all of these factors, you say, can be figured out, which I guess leads you to an idea that there can be some kind of solution, there can be some way of at least approaching the problem.
Yes, certainly. Some people trying to evaluate this problem, and it is on the ground very confusing and very difficult with much conflicting evidence, conclude, well, we can't even begin to understand this. It's almost like a random whirlwind of violence in these cities. You look at Ciudad Juárez, the hardest hit city in Mexico. Last year, there were 3,000 murders, more than 3,000 murders. The vast majority haven't been solved and certainly haven't been solved satisfactorily. They sometimes arrest some, say, this guy killed 200 people. You know, where's the real evidence there that he did commit those murders? So people start to look at this and say, well, really, we can't even begin to understand this. And some of the frameworks we put on this, saying it's just two cartels fighting, are simplifying the problem. But when you start to try and break this down, you can look at certain time frames when the violence escalated in 2004, in 2006, in 2008, in 2010. You can look at government policies which are not working. You can look at certain movements within this conflict. So it is crucial for us as journalists and as a society to look at this, because we have to try and stop this whirlwind of violence. I mean, right now we're talking about more than 40,000 murders related to this conflict in the last 5 years, up to 10,000 more disappearances of people who've just never been seen again, which is even more painful for many families when their child just disappears. Now, that is very bad, but what if it gets much worse than this? What if it becomes, you know, 80,000, 100,000 dead? This is very destabilizing for the region. So we really have to understand this and say, look, what is happening here and what can we do about it to reduce the violence and to reduce the power of these organizations?
The stakes for those who supply information got to be pretty high. I mean, that, and it has to add a troubling element to, or difficult element to, collecting information for this story. In the book, you talk about how five of your sources who you interviewed, who in fact shaped the book, they were killed or disappeared, though you're not sure it had anything to do with the book. But still, how dangerous is it for you there as you are now in Mexico City to be covering a story like this?
Well, it's certainly a very violent, intimidating environment. Like I say, five sources who I interviewed over a long time span, over several years, were subsequently murdered. In one case, the person I interviewed him on a Thursday, I was phoned up on a Tuesday morning to say the person had been assassinated. He was an anti-drug policeman. It's certainly very difficult. There's certainly been a systematic attack on Mexican journalists in frontline areas where journalists have been threatened consistently. Some have been murdered, or several Mexican journalists have been murdered, and colleagues I've known have been killed. So it's a very difficult environment to report on. We have to take a lot of care about what we do. We have to apply a certain amount of self-censorship when I write the book I write, and when I write my reports. I don't want to give any information which is directly compromising to the cartels. I want to write the bigger picture. the bigger picture, which is very useful to society, very useful to the public to understand it, but is not going to immediately anger a drug trafficker, you know, who could take some steps. So we have to be very careful in what we do, and through years we learn how to report this story, taking great care about ourselves.
Yoan Grillo is with us. His book is called El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Yoan Grillo, who is joining us to talk about the rise of Mexican drug cartels. His book, called El Narco, is a sweeping portrait of the drug wars in Mexico. It's part history, how the drug narcos evolved from peasant smugglers to paramilitary death squads. Part of it is about culture, but another part is about where the insurgent movement seems to be headed and what can be done to stop it. El Narco, again, the name of the book, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Well, Yoan Grillo, let's talk about the history, as you do in the book, where you sort of trace the transformation of these groups. It all seems to begin, you write, in the mountains of Mexico, Sierra Madre. The earliest drug traffickers, I guess, grew opium. Opium is where it seems to have started?
That is correct. The first traffickers or significant traffickers to the United States from Mexico were in fact Chinese immigrants or Chinese Mexicans. A wave of Chinese immigrants came to Mexico at the end of the 19th century and brought the opium poppies with them and planted them locally where they, you know, really took root and began to flower. So when the United States first made opium illegal after 1914, the first traffickers came from there and they began to create these cross-border networks almost 100 years ago, which have since were later expropriated by Mexican traffickers themselves. Now, the fact you see it's got 100 years in the making shows how deep these traffickers are in the communities, how deep roots they have, and how entrenched they are in many places.
It's interesting. You also write about how this idea of drug prohibition, you know, we like to think that there have always been prohibitions on drugs, but you write about it as a sort of relatively new phenomenon. And the debate over drug policies and laws, it's always been clouded, you say, by emotion and superstition, things like that.
That's right. If you look at the history of drug policy around the world, this, you know, first began to come in following that the Harrison's Act in 1914 in the United States. Before then, opium was sold legally, cocaine was sold legally. It was on a much smaller level than it is now. And in the early days, some of the stories that affected drug policy were some very charged stories. We can look at how there were stories of Chinese men alleged to use opium to rape white women and other kind of fiction like that. Other stories saying that cocaine made African Americans in the South invincible to bullets. And these kind of rumors, which now we can look back and say, well, that's absurd. But often, you know, you get kind of new rumors coming around with drugs now. So it's been a debate that's often been very clouded. And there's hasn't been very effective policy towards it. We've seen in the last 40 years since the war on drugs was declared by President Richard Nixon, we've seen a rise in an amazing rise in drug violence in this part of the world. So we've definitely seen a very kind of twisted history, a rocky road of drug policy so far.
A lot of this history also reaches back to the history of civil strife in Mexico, where they've dealt with a lot of civil problems. This question of security is one of those issues you say the country's always struggled with ever since independence. That's a factor you have to take into account when you think about the broader story here.
Yeah, I think if you look right now, the violence in Mexico is very historic, and I realized this covering the story when we got to about 2008, and the violence was really increasing, and these armed groups were roaming around the country, and people here start to say, this is the biggest amount of violence we've seen since the Mexican Revolution. Mm. Since then, we have not seen so many militias roaming the countryside. We've seen refugees now, hundreds of thousands of people leaving their homes in villages and so forth because they're scared of these armed groups. So you start to see this conflict is way beyond just drug gangs fighting. Now the drugs are funding these insurgent militias, these criminal warlords that are really starting to fragment the country. And if we look back in the history, we've seen many times of violent conflict in Mexico. It's been a very complicated, difficult country since it gained independence from Spain in 1821. We've always seen this country where there was millions of dispossessed, where there was small elites with much of the resources, and where many parts of the country were a long way from the arm of the federal government, where there's been a long history of bandits and then criminal warlords and so forth. So we have to look at the present Mexican drug war, as I like to call it. It's a real serious armed conflict now in this country. There's been more deaths related to the war here last year than there were in Afghanistan, for example, in the conflict in Afghanistan. It is a historic occurrence right now that we're dealing with.
Mm. It's interesting, too, when you think about the more sort of current civil condition. A bit more than 10 years ago, the PRI falls from power, and everyone thinks there's going to be this great blossoming of democracy in Mexico. In fact, the cartels blossom during this time, which is it's almost counterintuitive that it would work that way.
Yeah, well, it's a very tragic counterproduct of Mexico's move from one-party rule to democracy. But there's a certain logic to all of this. Like when you saw in the Soviet Union, when you had one all-powerful party there in power from 1917 to 1991, the Soviet Communist Party, whatever its bad sides were, was very good about containing crime, containing organized crime. When the Soviet Union collapsed, you had an emergence of powerful gangsters, including many ex-government people, many ex-KGB people or ex-military special forces started working for the gangsters. Now, the same thing happened in Mexico. You had one all-powerful party in power in Mexico from 1929 till 2000. Mm. And when the party left power, you started to get military special forces guys becoming mercenaries and these kind of armed militias emerging and gangsters really starting to overwhelm security forces. Now, it's a very tragic counterproduct because people were a long time hoping for this freedom, like journalists were hoping for freedom, and before they were censored by the government, now they're being censored by organized crime. Many business people used to have to pay off, bribes to the government. Now they fear being kidnapped by gangsters and having to pay off gangsters. So a very sad side product. And one thing that could happen in next year's presidential elections is people may vote back that old party of power, the PRI, who's in control for 71 years, could come back into power because people say, we're fed up now. We were promised a great multi-party democracy. What we're seeing is disorder and chaos and insecurity.
So the old regime may have been corrupt and authoritarian, but I guess it was kind of ruthless when it dealt with the cartels. That people would rather have it that way, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, many people say, look, we're very scared now. In many communities, they're saying, I can't get on with my life. We've seen a case in Acapulco, the great tourist resort with a history of Johnny Weissmuller and Elvis Presley there back in the 1960s. We're seeing that city being really terrorized by drug gangs and even school teachers being forced to pay money to these drug cartels. That's what we're talking about. They don't just traffic drugs. They also tax or shake down businesses. Now, they do that to gain money, but also to exercise a control over these communities. They become like a predatory shadow government in these places. So people start to say, well, if I can't get on with my life, if I can't even take my children to school without fear of gangsters, if I can't have my business without fear of gangsters. I prefer an authoritarian government, or even I prefer, you know, foreign intervention, and then we have the, you know, the spectre of American troops getting involved in this in the future as well.
Yoan Grillo is with us. We're talking about his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Let's go to the phones. Larry is joining us in Orem, Utah. Larry, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. You're actually talking about my question right now. Central question is this. How realistic is it that there will be what could be a complete failure of the Mexican government because of the activities of these cartels? Do they have that kind of resource and organization that they could bring down the government?
Well, I think Mexico's government will not collapse in the same way that some governments have in other parts of the world. Rather than being a failed state, I think it's more likely to become a captured state. The drug traffickers aren't interested in providing electricity or running schools. They want to run their operations, and then they're happy to let the government still, you know, run certain institutions, but they want to have a monopoly of security in certain parts of the country. Like I said, they want to tax people. They become like a predatory shadow government. Now, it's a very terrifying reality in these parts of the country which are controlled by drug gangs, because if you have a member of your family kidnapped in that part of the country, you know, you wonder if the police are really controlled by the drug cartel. You know, who can you turn to? And you feel it's best to pay up the money. So it becomes a very painful reality. But I don't think it's a collapse of a government like we've seen in some parts of Somalia, for example, which is a much more less advanced country without the kind of resources that Mexico has.
But it's interesting you do write about a real fragmentation of the state government, federal police, for example, versus the state police. I mean, and it seems like in some ways a little like Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, you've drawn that parallel between how it works in Mexico with these military forces coming from, you know, from the south, and the residents of these northern border towns don't see them as liberators or protectors. It just seems to complicate the problem. There are human rights abuses. I mean, if you're a resident in any of those communities, you've got to be incredibly conflicted and confused.
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. And the central issue is the fragmentation of the state and the fighting between different security forces. We see, for example, I mean, extraordinary things happening. In one state, Durango, we saw the prison authorities allowing some prisoners to leave the jail, cross state lines into Coahuila, commit massacres, in some cases using guns provided by prison authorities, and then go back to the jail at night and sleep in their cells. So we see a complicity in an extraordinary way of one state government against another state. And we see this again and again. And when we've seen state police in Michoacán actively involved in attack on federal police forces. So this is the real problem, is, you know, the different political parties often control different police forces or the army and fight against each other. So one solution could be the unification of all Mexico's police forces under one central command. And that's a bit controversial. It sounds a bit authoritarian, but it could be one way to start getting out of this mess.
I wonder, it seems like there was a transition at some point during all of this over the last five, six years, when the tactics, which began as, you know, intimidation, there were shootings, certainly, but then the violence sort of got ratcheted up and became really, truly savage. What was the transition? How did the beheadings, for example, all of those kinds of things, how did that turn?
I think the crucial change that's happened in Mexico is the move from gangbangers, from thugs, to paramilitary groups. If you look back at the 1990s in Tijuana, for example, many of the killers there actually were born in the United States, were immigrants from the United States who went back to Mexico and were kind of guys with shaved heads and tattoos using handguns. And that was the drug-related violence. It was a crime problem, a problem of thugs. And we started to see the emergence of paramilitary units, of units organized alongside military lines with heavy weapons. And this began with this group, the Zetas, who had defectors from the Mexican special forces who were highly trained. And when they created these groups, the other gangs to fight them said, well, if you have a paramilitary death squad, I need one as well. So all of that drug money began being used to finance these groups. Now, some of these people came from Guatemala, who were mercenaries from Guatemala who had fought in the Guatemalan Civil War, attacking the rebel villages. Now, when they attacked rebel villages, they used to chop off the heads of people to stop them joining the insurgency in that country. They came to Mexico and began to apply those same rules, those same ideas of, like, now, how do we control territory? We use it by trying to spread terror. And it became an escalation, you know, with no bounds on them. It became a, you know, a military-style conflict. And so you see one gang chops off five heads, another gang will chop off 10. One will put a car bomb, will burn down an entire building. So this escalation has been rising and rising, and we don't know where this escalation will lead to.
Yoan Grillo is with us. He's a journalist, a writer, a TV producer living in Mexico City. We're talking about his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We will take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Yoan Grillo. We're talking about his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. As we said earlier, a good part of the book sort of breaks down the culture of these drug cartels. I wanted to ask, is there a do they have a kind of agenda beyond just making money? I mean, is the culture evolving in some way? Has it taken on a kind of perverse sort of, you know, nationalism or something? Or is it just about making money in the end?
Most of it really is about making money, but you have seen some funny transgressions on a regional level. You saw one group called La Familia Michoacana who claimed to be evangelical Christians who are putting a new order in their community, and they mix a kind of certain interpretation of evangelical Christianity with a kind of peasant revolt politics, the kind of Emiliano Zapata type idea of it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees. Now, you often see some drug traffickers giving away presents to children at Christmas and paying for medical bills of people in the community, and they try and offer themselves as being benefactors to the communities. Now, obviously, it's a very cynical reason. They want to buy support in their local area, but they try and pose as being, you know, we look after the community. And some drug cartels will say, well, we're not going to allow in our area kidnapping or extortion. We're going to murder those people and provide security for regular public people because the government is incapable of doing it. And there is some sympathy in some parts of the public to those kind of agendas in certain areas.
One of the really interesting parts of this culture is that they have their own music, their own, these narco corridos, that songs that, as you said earlier, sort of make them these iconic heroes. And I wanted to play an excerpt from one, a song called Jefe de Jefes. It's by a group called Los Tigres del Norte. Talk a little bit about this particular song, but also the idea of narco corridos in general. They're infused in, throughout this culture, it seems.
Well, these ballads, the corridos, actually have a long history in Mexico going back to the 18th century of telling stories about people and kind of passing news around communities before they moved into the recording industry. And often the idea of the narco corrido, the drug ballad, focuses on the idea of a godfather as a kind of mythological figure, the Scarface, the great, powerful person who can disappear in a puff of smoke and take on the government. Now, this song, El Jefe de Jefes, or Boss of Bosses, is maybe the most famous drug ballad of all time. If you look at classic rock songs, you can maybe compare it to something like Sympathy with the Devil or this kind of, you know, very iconic rock song. And it tells the story of a very powerful drug trafficker. It may be one particular person from the 1980s who's in prison, who's oversaw drug trafficking across much of Mexico, and about how, you know, he is the man who can make millions upon millions of dollars and who can escape the police wherever they, you know, they cannot find him anywhere.
So, Young Grillo, has this culture, has it become in some ways, has it taken on a kind of ordinariness in some ways, or is it infused with constant fear and constant violence? I mean, I can't imagine such a life would be very sustainable, but it seems to persist.
Well, among the traffickers themselves and the people involved in these cartels, they often, now they're growing up in this very painful war zone. There's some of them, you know, if they were born, people who are perhaps 14 years old in 2006 when the conflict really escalated, are now 19. So they've known this kind of area, you know, war zone in their communities. And many begin to have a very tragic mentality where they see themselves as dying young. They think, well, I'm going to die young. I'll probably be shot dead or be in prison in a couple of years. You know, let's make the most of my life now. Now, a very tragic number, which I discovered in Ciudad Juárez, in many of the neighborhoods there, is the price people will now charge to murder somebody. Some of the young people there will carry out a killing for just 1,000 pesos, which is about $85. Now, it really has to strike you as how much has society failed these people? How much has have things really fallen apart if somebody will kill somebody for $85? But in the communities, they say that still nobody is really coming to these kids and offering them anything apart from the drug cartels, who arrive there and say to these people, if you want to work, you know, we'll give you a job. If you want to try and make something with your life, we'll give you a chance. So the government or social workers really need to get into these communities and offer something to these people.
Let's go back to the phones. Paul is with us in Salt Lake City. Paul, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Excellent program today. I'm just curious if your guest knows about any U.S. Government assistance in the areas of spy technology. I mean, are we using drones or satellites or anything to track drug shipments or infiltrate staging locations and port activity? I mean, you see the effectiveness of this in Pakistan and Yemen. I mean, the ability to pinpoint a specific house and laser guide a you know, cruise missile or a drone missile attack right on it. And are we doing anything to assist the Mexicans in actually pinpointing the nexus of these activities?
Yes, certainly. The United States has provided unmanned drones to help spot targets on the ground. And they have been effective in helping the Mexican government find some of these warlords. What's even more important is really the intelligence gathered on the ground, and American agents have been working undercover. There's, in my book, I have a profile of one American agent who infiltrated a Mexican drug cartel and a Colombian drug cartel and survived that and provided information. against these organizations. So that it is definitely happening. One central problem is that even though the Mexican government working with the United States has been very effective about taking down major figures, and we've seen more than a dozen major warlords being taken down in the last 5 years. We've seen 90,000 cartel operatives arrested, another 40,000 who have been killed, sometimes by each other, sometimes by government forces. But it only makes the situation worse. And the problem is that when you take down these warlords, their rivals or their lieutenants start to fight over their empires. So you get a real cycle of violence that has been getting steadily worse. And in Mexico right now, we have 7 major cartels. So even when you attack one, it only strengthens the other 6. And that's one of the real catch-22 situations in this conflict.
Paul, glad you called. Thanks very much. In the book, you talk about how there has to be a drastic rethinking of the war on drugs in order to keep the conflict from turning into a full-scale civil war. I guess what part, because you do write about this, what part does the idea of legalizing drugs, I mean, what role does the, you know, the demand that's coming from the United States, what role does that play? And the idea of legalizing drugs, where does that fit into the conversation?
Well, whatever your politics are, we all concede that American users fund these organizations. We think that American users buying cocaine, crystal meth, marijuana, and heroin end up giving about $30 billion every year directly to these Mexican cartels. Now, over 10 years, that's $300 billion. So if you look at how these cartels are so powerful now, how they're overwhelming the Mexican military, it's if you had $300 billion in the last 10 years, well, so you can buy a lot of guns with that and you can corrupt a lot of policemen and so forth. If we think in the next 10 years, another $300 billion going to these groups, again, that can pay for a lot of assassins, buy a lot of bullets, buy a lot of guns, and cause a lot of problems. So we really have to think about reducing the money going to the cartels. Now, in terms of legalization, my book is not a book about legalization specifically.
Right.
That's a big debate which many people have and already have their opinions about. But I will say that if Americans smoke U.S. marijuana rather than buying the Mexican illegal product, it will reduce the money going to the cartels. Now, if you look at drugs like heroin, it's obviously a complicated issue. No one wants to legalize heroin. But there are programs that you can try and get addicts taking methadone, for example, having treatment where addicts are not providing money to organized crime, but they are, you know, getting treatment and stopping them being inside this sphere. Now, if you reduce the money going to organized crime in Mexico, like right now, if it's $30 billion every year, if it goes down to $20 or to $10 billion, then that could really help in the struggle against these groups and stop them being so overwhelmingly powerful like they are today.
I wanted to come back to Gonzalo for a bit. We talked about him at the beginning. This was one of the narco characters that you talked to in a prison in Ciudad Juarez. And you write about how he seemed so changed in some ways, like that he had found God, for example, in the prison, and seemed gentle in many ways. But then he also did some incredibly unspeakable sort of things. And one of the questions you ask is, does Gonzalo deserve, you know, redemption? Does someone who committed such crimes deserve, I don't know if even forgiveness is the correct word. Where have you come to on the thinking about Gonzalo? And do you think much about him in that way still?
Yes, it's a very central question. He had become a born-again Christian inside prison. There was a wing of born-again Christians in the prison in Juarez. So I actually went to a mass where I saw these prisoners who had committed murder and drug trafficking were kind of slam dancing and praying and so forth. Whatever my moral decision is not really that important. I think it's important to know that some people, through finding God, in some ways have found a life out of crime. Whatever I decide In Mexico, there is no death penalty. The Mexican military has an effective death penalty on the street in some ways because many gangsters are shot down. But there is no death penalty there. Under the Mexican system of justice, they supposedly should find a way of kind of redemption and so forth. What I think is very important to look at is trying to find a way to stop the violence. How can we make the less violence? And we have to find some ways of getting young people out of organized crime. Now, if some of these people see no way out at all, and some of them have been recruited into these criminal paramilitary insurgent organizations since they were young teenagers, some as young as 13 or 14 years old, start off by making phone calls just to spot a vehicle going past, and then soon they're committing murders. We need some kind of way of getting them out of this conflict, of demobilizing these forces. Because if they see no way out at all, they're going to just continue fighting. So there has to be some kind of process there where you can look for peace. And peace is the most important thing for the communities. Because one thing I haven't really talked about enough in this interview is how much human beings, the civilians, have really suffered in Mexican communities. And I've talked to many mothers who have lost their children, who have been shot down in crossfire, innocent 16-year-old boy in one case who went to fix the family car with his older brother and was shot dead. And that kind of suffering is really scarring people, and we have to find a way out of that and try and save these people.
Yoan Grillo, his book is called El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, joined us from a studio in his home base of Mexico City. Yoan Grillo, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.